They said it was sabotage, possibly murder. But the DA in the Baldwin movie disaster says, hold your fire. Why the armorer's lawyers may want to retreat. Tonight on Banfield, the hottest legal headlines with an all-star lineup. I'm talking all three judges from TV's Hot Bench. And then, catching monsters using little girls. Behind the high-tech smoke and mirrors of a 38-year-old mom convincing online predators she's only 12. Straight ahead. Hello and welcome to Banfield. Who says there was foul play on the Rust movie set? Not the district attorney, that's for sure. She has just thrown a big bucket of cold water on the inflammatory comments that were made by the lawyers for that young armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. But that is not stopping those lawyers from sticking to their sabotage claims and throwing in some wild new theories for good measure. And while the criminal side is being sorted out, pack the wheelbarrows full of money because the lawsuits have just begun. That gaffer on the movie, the one who befriended the late cinematographer and who called out the safety shortcuts, he is the first to file suit against Alec Baldwin and almost two dozen others. His name is Serge Svetnoy, and he claims he personally suffered severe emotional distress because of the negligence of other crew members and production staff. And while I could go on, I'm going to stop right here and bring on some legal luminaries that you might well recognize.
It's certainly not our job to decide how much profit he can make when she freely and voluntarily accepts the deal.
I think we should look at contracts if they're unconscionable.
Saying it wasn't unconscionable.
No, it was not. No. It was not unconscionable.
Oh, I would agree with you based upon the evidence that
So what'd you get us all agitated for?
You misunderstand my style.
No,
my style. My style is very clear. I ask questions that I think are issues.
Well, you hear them and you're going to hear more of them. Judge Tanya Acker, Judge Patricia DiMango, and Judge Michael Corriero. They deal with the hottest legal issues of the day. They're the stars of TV's Hot Bench. Welcome to all three of you. I'm so glad because I don't know what happened this week in courtrooms across the country, but it was a little off the rails. Let me just start with the Alec Baldwin story. The lawyers for the armorer are using words like sabotaged and framed and tampered, and then, you know, the hidden meaning is murder, all while the DA is saying, no, absolutely not. I just don't understand how this happens when they're hearing the DA, but carrying on and amping it up even further. Tanya, let me start with you, your reaction to hearing that.
Well, look, I mean, if any criminal defendant, well, let me back up because we don't have a charge yet, but anybody in this kind of situation is going to look for a reason why they shouldn't be liable. So it's all well and good for these sabotage theories to be floated about, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to put forward facts. They will have to put forward facts to support that theory. If there are facts to support that theory, then the DA should consider it. If there are no facts to support it, then it really, it can't go very far in a legal case. That's not how courts work.
That's not how courts work. You are right. And the funny thing is that this is one of those high profile cases. It's playing out in the media before there is even a charge, as you so rightly pointed out, Tanya. So I want to play for you what the DA said on Good Morning America, because it sounded to me like she was pretty darn clear. Don't float your conspiracy theories to try to deflect whatever it is you're trying to deflect. Have a listen to this.
I know that some defense attorneys have come up with conspiracy theories and have used the word sabotage. We do not have any proof.
Do you believe sabotage is a possibility?
No.
Okay, well, that's pretty clear. Patricia, I'm wondering if there are defense attorneys representing all sorts of people on that set right now, on the Baldwin set, taking copious notes and getting ready for the day they may hear there are charges and, you know, possibly indictments.
Actually, they are, and there's going to be any number of people that are going to be held responsible or be sought after to be held responsible for what happened here. And the interesting part is that lawyers often want to put out their information to taint whatever jury pool might actually end up happening at some point. And it's almost like the more you say it, the more likely someone will believe it. And right now, the armorer seems to be the person who is most responsible for handling the weapon directly. That's that person's job to check the state of load. The armorer is actually trained and certified in doing all this. And so deflecting from Ms. Gutierrez would certainly be something that would be in the interests of her attorneys. And the more people that you can point the finger at, the more you dilute the case against your own client. And, you know, prosecutor could say anything she wants right now. She doesn't know how the evidence is actually going to turn out.
Yeah, we're still pretty early into this game. I know it doesn't feel like it on TV, but these cases can often go months and months before there's a charge. Heck, I've seen cases not charged for years until the evidence comes
Absolutely.
In. The clock starts ticking. Yeah, I mean, you have a right to speedy trial, and if you get charged, you got to have some goods behind it. Okay, so I want to play for you something that happened, and I was expecting it. I know the three of you were expecting it. You all know how the game works. But the gaffer on that set, the one who's been so outspoken, the one who was really close by and said that Helena Hutchins died in his arms, his name is Serge Svetnoy. He is the first to launch a suit. I am expecting there will be likely many more, but I want to just let you hear what his attorney had to say when they made the announcement. Take a peek.
This lawsuit is not about his desire to make money at all. This lawsuit is to bring awareness to a problem and to prevent it in the future. This lawsuit is to make these kinds of unsafe conditions that happen too much on movie sets stop now.
Okay, Michael Corriero, Alec Baldwin is one of the many defendants. I don't think that surprises you. But at the same time, if you were judging this case and trying to sort out who really has the exposure in all of this, who has the money bags, well, this is Hollywood and, you know, Alec Baldwin has some money, but this was a cheap production, what would you be thinking right about now?
Well, taking the attorney's representations at face value, I think he's framing his lawsuit in a very noble way, that the purpose behind it is to make sure that no one else gets injured or hurt or killed in a situation like this. And that's a very noble endeavor. And as far as who is responsible, there are different levels and duties of responsibility that's kind of apportioned throughout the entertainment industry. So there are a lot of people who may very well have shared in some responsibility. And the question of who is more negligible is something that can be considered. And certainly who has the most capacity to pay if they're more guilty than somebody else, then that's also going to be something that the lawyers are going to take into account. So I think this will be a very important suit for the entertainment industry, given what happened here and what we know so far about the underlying facts.
I always wonder if there's enough money in any kind of insurance policy that these movies have to cover something this awful, right? And there is now another potential, I mean, listen, there's a guy who's really, really sick in the hospital. He was bitten by a spider while tearing down that set, and that shouldn't be ignored. He's part of that production. It was a brown recluse, which is one of the most deadly spiders, and he's lost most of his arm. They're fighting for his life now, not just to save his arm. So there's more coming in this, you know, very, very sad, you know, story that's evolved. So, Judge Tanya, let me ask you about Alec Baldwin, because I hear this question a lot, covering law for 15 years now. The famous they skate. You know, look at OJ, look at Robert Blake, look at Michael Jackson. The famous, they get away with everything. But I've also talked to Mark Garagos on how, no, the scrutiny is even more acute when it comes to the famous because nobody wants to be accused of giving them a pass. What do you make of that dynamic?
Well, I think your latter point, Ashley, is a really good one. This case is going to get so much scrutiny. It already has been scrutinized. We're only going to see that intensify as the legal proceedings develop. And I think it's really important to remember that when there are legal proceedings, that's very different than social media proceedings or media proceedings. In the legal proceedings, the facts against Alec Baldwin in this civil suit will be examined. So it's not just about the soundbite, oh, rich people get off, famous people get off. Certainly, wealthy folks have an advantage in the system because they can hire great lawyers. But that really is not the end of the analysis. I mean, this a lawsuit will look at duties. A lawsuit will look at obligations. A lawsuit is not simply going to examine, you know, what is the trending hashtag on Twitter and go from there. So it's a much sharper analysis than I think we'll just get in the media or online.
So I want you guys to look at some of the things that have happened online because they're living this case out loud, right? It's to their credit, a lot of the people on the set are not speaking to the media, but Alec Baldwin and his wife Hilaria are talking a lot. You know, there was Alec and Hilaria out on Roadside, Vermont, saying all sorts of things that they probably shouldn't have said, trying to be as innocuous as possible, but it, you know, it was out there. And then on social media, Alec Baldwin retweeted a 7-page defense of the costume designer. And that was really intense, saying that the charges that the production was unsafe and producers were uncaring were just not right. I mean, look at all that. That's just a huge collection of you know, correcting the record. These producers who supposedly don't care about their crew have worked tirelessly alongside us, she said. And he tweeted that. He retweeted it. And then he tweeted something else. He said that there should be police on movie sets. And when a commenter said, yeah, that's the job of the armorer, he commented back and said, we had one of those. Judge Patricia, I can only imagine that these are things that will live in a record somewhere if he ends up in litigation. I mean, he's going to end up in litigation, right? He's already been sued. There could be criminal liability here. These are the things you'll see pop up in court, right?
Well, you know, sometimes what you've said out of court can't always be used in court, but on occasion, you can often be cross-examined with regard to prior statements that you've made when you take a different position at trial. Now, of course, if he's going to be charged as a defendant, he has an absolute right not to testify, not to make a statement. These are not custodial statements. They're not made to the police. So I think there's probably going to be a very limited use for them, if any at all, at a trial. But people are out there. They just want to kind of spread the responsibility, because the more you can spread the responsibility, the more you can confuse the facts, the jurors, and the more likely that you can get an acquittal or a jury that's not going to, in a criminal matter, that can possibly be a, cannot reach a verdict. So there's a lot of things that could happen. And now everybody's going to be out there talking until someone is actually charged. And you're totally right, Ashley. There is going to be, Alec Baldwin isn't going to walk out of this scot-free, at least with charges, whether or not they hold, whether or not the evidence supports the charges as to any of them. Of course, as we're all saying here, this all remains to be seen. This is a very new case. I mean, New Mexico does not really want to. They make a lot of money on these shows, that having people there filming. So they really don't want to, I would imagine, encourage a criminal liability. And as for civil responsibility, it's very nice and righteous to say, you know, this isn't about the money. But I think if the jury came back and the judge said, why don't we all just say, you know, I'm sorry, it won't happen again, I don't know how happy people would be with that either. So this is just so interesting on so many different levels.
It really is. And when it comes right down to it, it's about Helena Hutchins, right? It's about this lovely young woman with such an incredibly promising career. I hope she doesn't get lost in this. Like, that's what justice is about. Justice is about remembering these folks and making sure that there aren't more of these folks Meaning victims. Okay, Judge Michael, real quickly, I want to show you something from Sunday night in New York. The Baldwins, Alec and Hilaria, do not like the press. Alec has not liked the press for a long time. I think we all kind of know that. And so Hilaria has, it seems, taken on the henchman role, letting Alec go inside, and then she stays out and engages with the paparazzi to suggest that they shouldn't be there, and that somehow she could end up dead one day. That's my interpretation. I want you guys to have a look. Take a peek.
I hope you remember my face one day. And if something ever happens to me because of this kind of thing, if something ever happens to me, remember that I asked you.
Remember my face in case something happens to me one day. All right. It's all, you know, kind of interesting to watch. But in the end, is Hilaria helping the matter, Judge Michael, or is it just sort of, you know, it's just media. That's all it is.
Well, I understand how the Baldwins might want to correct the record to deal with the incredible amount of information, whether it's accurate or not, that seems to be on the internet and what appears in the paper. So I can understand their frustration. We live in a society where the right of privacy is up for grabs, so to speak, especially in these cases. And if you happen to be a celebrity, then you may very well feel that your life has to be an open book, or others might feel that way. So I can understand their concern, because they must be getting a lot of negative remarks or threats from people on the internet, and it can be overwhelming at times. And so you talked about justice, and we want to see justice in this case. I don't think that anything that Alec Baldwin said in his remarks before would be inculpatory. I think he's trying to address allegations that haven't yet been established in court. And in all fairness to him, I don't think it's a matter of his not liking the press, but I think the press also has a responsibility to make sure that people who do have some sense of celebrity are not persecuted simply because of it.
And I always say that the more you... aren't you adorable? But I do think that the more you engage, the more paparazzi show up, because when you get that, that's gold. You know, they sell those confrontations. Yeah. It's like, if you want them to go away, just ignore them. It's an age-old lesson. Okay, guys, if you could stay put, I want you to get comfy because we're just getting started. I don't know how you do your jobs as judges. When we come back, a legal fight as old as the courtroom itself. Judges versus lawyers, but hooey, this week was a doozy. Take a look.
That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that.
I do not need an explanation. I do not need an apology. None of that. But I would suggest that we take a moment and think about the way that you're reacting to the court's instructions and rulings. We're in recess.
Is there something that I'm saying that draws the face that you're making?
Okay, you want hot topics? You should hang out in a courtroom. Welcome back with my special guests. They are the renowned attorneys and judges from the hit TV series Hot Bench, Judge Tanya Acker, Judge Patricia Domingo, and Judge Joseph Corriero. Great to have the three of you. I'm so glad that you all three could be here on a week where I feel like my head has been hanging, sort of open mouths and with what's going on with judges and with court cases. But I want to start with this one. In the Kyle Rittenhouse case, something weird happened, and I really think your expertise is going to be helpful here. The star witness for the prosecution, tricky name, Gage Grosskreutz. I hope I got it right. He went on the stand yesterday and kind of like did the oopsie. The prosecution didn't want this, but he admitted that, yep, okay, Kyle, I pointed a gun at Kyle. I pointed my gun at Kyle. Take a look at how he said it on the stand.
Does this look like right now your arm is being shot?
That looks like my
bicep being vaporized, yes.
Okay. And it's being vaporized as you're pointing your gun directly at him. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so when you were standing 3 to 5 feet from him with your arms up in the air, he never fired, right?
Correct.
It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, with your gun, now your hands down, pointed at him, that he fired, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's not what you want if you're the prosecutors in this case. You don't want your star witness to say, yeah, I was pointing a gun at the guy whose entire defense is self-defense, right? Here's the weird thing. That same witness went on GMA, and he was questioned by Michael Strahan about what he said, and he flipped the picture. He said, nope, I didn't point that gun. So here's how he said it. Take a look.
In that photo, given the right narrative, one could suggest that, yes, I was pointing my weapon at the defendant. But when you play it as a movie or look at different stills, my arm was being vaporized as I was allegedly pointing my weapon at the defendant. It's completely inconsistent with the physiology of my wound that he would have shot me while my weapon was pointed at his head.
Okay, Judge Tanya Acker, I don't know what to make of it. I feel as though the prosecutor should have brought that back and impeached him with it in a rebuttal case. That didn't happen. But that doesn't sound right to people who want real justice and truth in a courtroom.
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting that during the interview, he says, you know, it might be suggested. Well, the truth is he did suggest it, and he didn't just suggest it. He basically said it. And when you are in trial, what happens in court is the record. All of that stuff that happened on, you know, outside of court, the extrajudicial statements, you know, arguably the prosecution could say we want to bring him back on or we want to put this into the record. But once you have established a record, once you have a witness on the stand who gives you key facts and then says, you know what, maybe in an interview I'm going to try to soften it, that second version is not going to be as powerful or as potent. And frankly, it may not even be admissible. You know, if you want to make a suggestion about what happened during the critical events, you make that suggestion while you are testifying under penalty of perjury in a court of law. You know, the interview on GMA afterwards is not going to clean up your testimony necessarily.
No, it's true. Okay, but then to the judge now, because I know you guys have all seen the fireworks between the judge and the prosecutor yesterday. So I thought that was all over with. And then today, again, I had to pop popcorn because they went at it again. And I just wanted to play it for you because you guys are judges and I'm going to ask you about temperament. So take a look at this.
Is there something that I'm saying that draws the face that you're making?
Go
ahead. Say what you want to say.
I have to say, Your Honor, yesterday I was the target of your ire for disregarding your orders. Today, the defense is disregarding your order. Yesterday, as I said, I was under the court's ire.
You know, I don't want to talk about...
Well,
why don't we just...
I think it's a fundamental fairness issue, Your Honor.
All right, say what you want to say.
If I'm being held to obey the court's orders, I'm asking that the defense be held to that, too. This is something we litigated at a Daubert hearing. We spent time on this.
You know, I am going to interrupt you, and then I'm going to let you talk again. But I was talking yesterday about the Constitution of the United States and how the Supreme Court has interpreted it for 50 years. That's not what we're talking about here today.
Judge Patricia DeMango, look, it's fun to talk about temperament. It's fun to watch it. Does it matter when it comes to the case?
It actually does. I'm not sure whether or not at the time they had this colloquy or this back and forth bantering that the jury was present. And of course, a jury, most of the time, juries hold judges in high esteem. And they, if they like a judge, they kind of will kind of sway their view towards how the judge is behaving. So if they like a judge and they think the judge doesn't like the prosecutor or the defense attorney, that could impact on how they perceive what's going on in the courtroom. And, you know, but sometimes, if, let's say this was outside the presence of the jury, you know, no judge wants to declare a mistrial. No judge wants to take the jury, take the verdict away from the jury. They want to leave the case within the province of the jury. And so you really want to caution the lawyers. Sometimes you want to do it emphatically, and it might be by yelling, but because you really don't want to compromise the integrity of the proceeding. And short of declaring a mistrial when there's a manifest necessity to do so, you know, the judge has kind of, you know, he can give some limiting instructions, he could tell the jury to disregard things, but it's very difficult to take, once the cat is out of the bag, it's very difficult to kind of get that out of the juror's mind. And I think that the judge is really trying to persuade the prosecutor to stop doing, violating the court rules and orders. And, you know, now he's got the defense doing the same thing. He probably should treat them both equally. But if they're not, the jury's not there. I mean, these guys have to get, you know, they have to have thicker skin. The judge is upset and annoyed, and as he should be. You don't talk about the post-arrest silence. You don't talk about rulings that the judge has made clearly saying you're not to ask questions.
Yeah, he was right.
So, yeah, the judge has a right.
He was right. He was right. However, I will say this. The jury wasn't in the courtroom, but they were not in the jury room. They were in a library, and it was within shouting distance. And there's a reporter who said he could hear what was going on. So I'm very concerned that the jury might have, and I don't know if we'll hear about that. Stand, Pat, for a second, guys, because when we come back, I want to talk about the after effects of Astroworld. Travis Scott is now offering counseling to concert goers, and oh my Lord, did the internet ever clap back. But does that matter when you're facing down now upwards of 200 lawsuits? Back after this with the Hot Bench. A sad update to the Astroworld story. A ninth person has now died from her injuries. Her name was Barty Sahani. Her cousin and her sister were there with her. They said the layer of bodies was two people thick. They were fighting to come up to the top and breathe to stay alive. So just a very sad addendum to this. And there are still others who are critically ill in the hospital. I'm back with the renowned attorneys from the hit TV series Hot Bench, Judge Tanya Acker, Judge Patricia DeMango, and Judge Michael Carriero. All right. So, Michael, I want to ask you about the lawsuits. Already there have been 40 lawsuits that have been filed against Travis Scott and others. But there is a San Antonio lawyer who has already amassed over 100 plaintiffs and says by the end of just today, he thought it'd be 200. My question to you is, there were only two people on the safety manual who could officially stop the concert, festival director and the executive producer. But does that get Travis off the hook himself, being that he's on stage with a mic and everybody listens to him?
Well, I think the question of his liability depends upon what he knew, what the factors were, what were the circumstances. I think that in this case, we have to determine whose duty it was to ensure the safety of the group that was there. And of course, the concert event promoters have a responsibility. The security people have a responsibility in that regard. And even an entertainer has a responsibility when he's aware of something going wrong in the audience. So there's a lot of responsibility here, a lot of duty here on the part of each one who profited from this event. And I think lawyers are going to try to make sure that their clients are compensated. I saw the mother of the ninth victim on television just a little while ago, and it was incredibly sad.
It's just heartbreaking.
For her daughter back. It's just heartbreaking. Yeah.
And, you know, so many of those people in that crowd are going to have so many traumatizing stories to tell. I'm going to go rapid fire here. I have a lot of legal issues I want to cover. All right, Tanya, yes. I'm going to start with you. The president of the Houston Professional Firefighter Association said that the district chief, Station 21, was pushed away twice at the beginning of that concert, wanted to go in and check. A security guard barred him from coming in, and then the head of security barred him from coming in. So huge exposure for the security team here.
I would want to know who gave the orders to prohibit the fire officials from coming in. And that could be a potential exposure. Absolutely. Potentially. Certainly.
And also just distressing to hear that a fire chief is being told, no, you can't come in to check. All right, Judge Patricia, Travis Scott is now offering to cover the concert goers' mental health expenses as well as the funerals. But then it came out that he's doing it in a partnership with something called BetterHelp, and you get a year of free online counseling. Some people are saying, well, that's pretty nice. And other people are saying, are you kidding me? We watched people die and we lost loved ones ourselves. And there's a lot of, you know, accusations that they don't think BetterHelp is a good company. In 2018, they were accused of unfair pricing and paying actors for reviews. But, you know, is that the sort of thing that people can cite in any kind of litigation against him, that he just didn't do enough?
You know, whether or not they can cite it in the litigation, I think just the general public has a certain sense. You know, when you're causing deaths, 9 deaths, and you kind of had a sense that you could have been part and parcel of this, and you've known in the past that you've had issues with this type of dangerous situation, I'm not sure whether or not that type of effort, paying for funerals, giving money for their tickets, returning them, and offering counseling, if it's going to be picked up. I mean, do they include marriage counseling in that as well for people who, it doesn't seem to me like a reasonable remedy or offer from him. I think the best offer would be make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Okay. Judge Michael, last question to you. After the show, Travis went to Dave and Buster's for an after party. The word is that he didn't know how serious, you know, the crisis was that he'd left behind, and that as soon as he did know, he left the party. But there is something called the Court of Public Opinion. And if there is any kind of litigation that ends up in front of a jury, that is the kind of thing that's not going to sound good.
Yeah, the Court of Public Opinion is something that everyone involved in this case has to be concerned about. And I think that his effort to make some kind of amends is something I think that I couldn't criticize under the circumstances. He's making an effort. This is a tragedy. I'm sure that everyone who was there and participated and put together the event feels quite responsible for what happened. Whether or not they're legally responsible, that will remain to be seen by the investigation that's done, which I believe and hope will be accomplished by an independent investigative source under these circumstances. Since so many people, so many different entities were involved in the security, if you will, of this event.
Well, I can't thank the three of you enough, and I hope that you're going to make this a regular stop. I've really enjoyed your wisdom and the camaraderie as well. Judge Tanya Acker, Judge Patricia DiMango, and Judge Michael Corriero from Hot Bench. Thank you. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Ashley.
You. Thank you.
Wow, what awesome guests. Okay. We have been warning our kids for years, you just don't know who you're talking to online, and that predators are lurking everywhere. Well, now the good guys are fighting back and doing some lurking of their own. Case in point, a 38-year-old mother of three who's been using special effects to de-age herself and reel in the bad guys. She is now officially a teenage survivor of a kidnapping. The 16-year-old girl whose story went viral this week after she used a hand signal. You've seen it, right? Made popular on TikTok. She did that to escape her abductor. 61-year-old James Herbert Brick got some bad news today. His unlawful imprisonment charge just got worse. It's now officially kidnapping, and his bail was boosted too, from $10,000 to $50,000. Brick was driving with the teen girl trapped in his car when she showed that distress signal to another driver. And that driver recognized the signal from social media, alerted the Kentucky Sheriff's deputies, and followed the car for 7 miles until the officer stopped the car and saved the girl. It is the very same hand signal that was seen in a PSA that was shot to look like the Gabby Petito body cam video. Only in this fictionalized version of the case, the young girl traveling in the van with her boyfriend is able to do the hand signal for the police, and she is rescued. Take a look.
Okay, so a lot going on here. I just wanted to show you something. So you see my hand? See where I put my thumb like that, close my hand like that? This is an international sign of domestic abuse. It's a way for people to do it in front of their abusers. Show me that sign if you do feel in any type of way. That way, you know, he doesn't hear anything. We just keep this work. Okay. All right, just hang tight.
We're both getting crazy and yelling at each other. You know what I mean?
Like, every single relationship.
But that's not what I want.
Can I talk to you?
That's not what I want.
Eerie to see that because it is so similar. You know, a lot of people are not aware of the hand signal, and even more people are unaware of the dangers that are lurking on the web. Countless adults are out there lying in wait to groom, sexually exploit, and abuse our kids. And my next guest is lurking out there too and catching predators. Rue Powell is a 38-year-old mother of three who started SOSA, a nonprofit keeping kids safe from online sex abuse. But she is also a 15-year-old Libby, 14-year-old Kate, and 13-year-old Ava, and a whole lot of other alter egos that she employs as predator bait. Her new docuseries is called Undercover Underage. It's on Discovery Plus. Rue Powell, it's so great to have you. Welcome, and I just love your work. Let me start with your work. How does a 38-year-old mom who already looks young look so much younger when you do your work?
And thank you so much for having me. Well, we use a lot of tricks, including wigs and makeup and prosthetics and braces and glasses. But then also we do really heavy digital editing to remove all of the things that make me a 38-year-old mom. So fine lines, stretch marks, all of the sins of aging.
So it's amazing that you actually get the graphics team involved and artificial intelligence to de-age yourself. But then there's the acting and then there's the character. How do you pick these characters, these names and these ages and these personalities? And how do you actually perform them? Because you really sound like you're 13.
Well, we can't just take a picture of a girl and put her online and hope for the best. We have to make a dimensional, multidimensional, layered teenage decoy, because that's what every teenage girl is, right? They've got families and social circles and activities. So we do the same for our decoys to make them as believable as possible. We give them each a name and a middle name and a birth date and an astrological sign and, you know, hobbies and siblings. And this is all important because when we're talking to would-be perpetrators, we need to be able to sell the story. And giving all of our decoys that dimension really helps do that.
So two questions in one. Number one, how do you figure out what their real identities are? And then how quickly do they turn your conversations right to what they want, and that's sex?
I think the unfortunate thing is that a lot of times people start right out of the gate as being sexual. The conversation can be sexual right away. Sometimes there is a longer grooming process where we see a lot of manipulation tactics, coercion happening, and sometimes that takes a little bit more time, but not necessarily months. I'm talking more like minutes, hours, and not much longer than that. As far as identifying them goes, what we're doing is we are extrapolating data from all of our conversations with them so we can ascertain who they are, whether that's, you know, getting clues from communicating with them or clues from photos they send us. That's all data that we use in order to help identify them.
It's just awesome. I mean, it is delicious in a million different ways to see the ensnaring of these guys. Okay, don't go anywhere, Rue. When we come back, I want to talk about the disturbing yet rewarding process that you and your team go through to have your alter ego, Alex, pull another predator out of a sickening sea. Take a look.
Like, together how?
You be with me. Yes.
How do we get married while I'm 15 now?
Welcome back to Banfield. I'm with Rue Powell, a 38-year-old mother of three who uses technology to shave years off her life and appear as an underage girl to catch online predators. Okay, this one, I want to continue what we were showing right before the break, and this is you as Alex. pulling off absolute magic, Rue. Let's take a look.
This is all set up for evidence, and we are rolling, so you are good to go.
Okay, if you could just tell everyone quiet.
Yeah. She's about to jump on a video call. Quiet all around, please.
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry about that video call, Hudson. You're beautiful. If we were together, I would just sit there and stare at you.
So you're far away, and I'm in Chicago. What does that mean for, like, our future?
Things that can be overcome. You're in the future. We can be together.
Like, together how?
You be with me. As my wife.
How do we get married while I'm 15 now?
You have to emancipate yourself first.
And you'd help me do that?
Yes, I would. People do it all the time. It went from my parents.
Ick, I want to vomit. I'm sure that you probably do as well, which makes you an even better actress because you're having to suppress all those feelings. You know, tell me that you are helping the police and that they are finding these people and that it is actually making a difference.
Yeah, so what we do is at SOSA, our goal is to, we get the evidence, we point out who the bad actors are, and then we hand that over to law enforcement. And then law enforcement takes that and runs with it in a number of ways. They might use it as a lead and do their own independent investigation. They might take over our accounts and they start communicating as Alex. Or they might work with us and I'm communicating as Alex while they're also logged in concurrently, seeing the messages come in so we can plan, we can make a plan to do what law enforcement does in a case like this. So we have been able to move the needle. Of course, our goal isn't just to take down perpetrators one by one. It's really to help end online sex abuse and exploitation, and we do that by empowering an entire society to combat it, not just by going after these bad actors one at a time, although that is certainly part of it, and we do think that's moving the needle as well.
I adore you officially. RuPaul, thank you for doing the work that you're doing, and congratulations on the six-part doc series on Discovery Plus. It's called Undercover Underage. And I just want to give a warning to our audience as well. If you suspect that a child is being targeted by a predator, you can contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children or the FBI using the numbers that we'll have up on the screen there, 1-800-CALL-FBI. Thank you, Ru.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also on this November 11th, if you haven't taken a moment to thank or think of a veteran, please do.